This podcast on the Searcy Institute Podcast Network is brought to you by our friends over at New College Franklin. Located in beautiful Franklin, Tennessee, New College Franklin is a four-year Christian liberal arts college dedicated to excellent academics and discipling relationships among students and faculty. They seek to enrich and disciple students intellectually, physically, emotionally, and spiritually to guide them to wisdom and a life of service to God, neighbors, and creation. And that intellectual development occurs through conversations in small classroom settings covering the great works of literature, philosophy, and theology, as well as the Trivium and the Quadrivium. If you would like to learn more about New College Franklin, head over to newcollegefranklin.org. Hello and welcome to Forma, a podcast featuring conversations with teachers, authors, creators, and community leaders who are carefully contemplating the nature and practice of classical education and the arts. I'm David Kern, and in this week's episode, we're bringing you an interview that I conducted with a good friend of ours, Joshua Gibbs. If you have been a reader of the Searcy website at all in the last few years, you have no doubt seen an article by Josh Gibbs over at his column, The Cedar Room. Josh is a gifted writer and speaker and teacher, and his story is really interesting. So a few years ago, he and I were kind of talking about that. And the way he described the story was that he went from being a really bad student to a pretty mediocre teacher. The way I put it is he went from perhaps being a really bad student to becoming a really good teacher. And that really good teacherness that is in him, that has sort of grown up in him, is something that certainly took some time, but it's also something that, because it took some time, it lent him perspective, and it helped make him more wise. I think that experience, that sort of struggle, if you will. And that's what his new book is about. His new book is called How to Be Unlucky: Reflections on the Pursuit of Virtue. And we were honored and excited to be able to publish that. It is out now. It came out this week. And we thought, let's get Josh on the podcast. Let's talk about his story. Let's talk about some of the ideas in the book and some of the things that he cares about. So yeah, as usual here on Forma, this is a pretty wide-ranging conversation, but I think that makes it really enjoyable. Josh is a great conversationalist, and I think that really shows up here, and I'm grateful that he joined me on the show. I hope you enjoy this episode of Forma. Well, Josh, thank you for joining me on the podcast once again. It's been a while. I think the last time we were talking about movies, does that ring a bell?
That's right. I think we were talking about kids' movies. We talked a lot about kids' movies.
Yeah, yeah. Again, when watching movies with kids.
Yeah, that's right.
We could talk about movies and kids' movies forever. Maybe we should avoid diving too far into that because we'd get easily distracted. We're here to talk about your new book, How to Be Unlucky: Reflections on the Pursuit of Virtue. So, and when we were originally talking about the book, and you were kind of pitching the idea, and one of the things that got talked about was kind of a memoir of going from being a, how did you put it, a bad student to a mediocre teacher, I think was how you put it, but I put a bad student to a good teacher. What do you mean when you talk about being a bad student? Like, were you that bad of a student?
Yeah, I was a really bad student. I had a few talents, and I mentioned this in the book. I had a few talents when I was younger as a student that made school somewhat easy to negotiate. And one of those talents was that I could write a well-turned phrase. And I didn't have anything of substance to say, but I was a decent stylist in high school. And that made me, I guess that made it even easier to be mediocre than it would have been if I couldn't write.
You were passable. Like, the teachers didn't quite notice how bad you were.
Right. Yeah. The teachers didn't notice quite how bad I was. It was this, as a decent stylist, the style was a facade that I could hide behind a little bit. And I think that the flimsiness and worthlessness of my ideas was a bit disguised. And that the poverty of my own imagination was also somewhat disguised behind being a competent writer, a competent stylist. But when I say also, when I saying that I was a bad student. I mean that I was always quite bored by school. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely not a criticism of the school I went to. That's a criticism of myself. I was never convinced of the value of school. I was never convinced of the value of the things that I read and studied. I was far more interested in my friends. I was far more interested in, you know, popular culture. And that made me a bored person who was also very kind of boring to be around, I suspect.
Yeah, I can't, someone in my life, and I wish I could remember who used to say that, you know, when I said, oh, I'm bored, he would say, only uninteresting people get bored.
Yeah.
Would you say would you accuse yourself of being uninteresting?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I'm not making some case, you know, that I've arrived and that I'm an interesting person. I'm sure I regularly disappoint people at conferences who try to strike up a conversation with me, you know, by offering some kind of initial, you know, compliment and saying, you know, I like your writing, or you wrote an essay that I really appreciated. And I mean, I often feel like I let people down, and, you know, I just kind of clumsy and easily distracted, or so I'm not claiming that I've, you know, arrived anywhere, but I am interested in the things that I used to be uninterested in.
Yeah.
Or disinterested in. But I couldn't blame any of my teachers in high school for kind of sighing on the inside whenever they had to call on me just for the sake of decorum. Like, yes, yeah. Josh. And thinking on the inside, nothing good is about to be said about whatever it is.
I'm gonna have to reharmonize the disorder that's about to happen in my classroom.
Right, you are about to screw a lot of things up for this conversation that we're going okay. But all right, what is it that you want to say?
How aware of that were you as a student? Like that's how teachers felt about it.
Completely oblivious. Okay. Completely oblivious. I think I've realized what an obnoxious student I was only after having some obnoxious students myself.
You started seeing yourself.
Oh, absolutely. That when I have some, you know, on the occasion that I have a student who's, you know, very enamored with the sound of their own voice, which I think often happens with a good stylist. I think a good stylist is enamored by the sound of their own voice.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've had students over the years, you know, typically male, typically, I don't know, they remind me of myself quite often, who just think that they have more to say than they really do. Mm. And that's not every teenager. That's not, you know, emblematic of the teenage years. I've got a lot of students that have more to say than they actually say.
Yeah.
But you know, on occasion you've got some boy who shoots off his mouth and says more than he really needs to. And I was that kid. And I think that I had to encounter that kid before I realized that I used to be that kid. So yeah, I don't think I recognized it at the time.
I was thinking about this the other day relating to parenting.
Yeah.
Because I mean, my kids are like yours are pretty young still. I think you guys are a couple years older than your girls are a little older than my boys, but you see something your kids do and you realize, oh, that was definitely me. No wonder my parents were so frustrated with this particular thing all the time or whatever.
Right.
So you recognized that after you started to have students that were like you.
Yes.
Do you look at those students that were like you then, or that, you know, that are like you used to be? And does that allow you to know how to communicate with those students? Like, can you empathize with that student in a way, or does it kind of almost cause you to go the opposite way of empathy? Maybe it's not the opposite way of empathy, mm-hmm. but to be more critical of them because you see yourself. Do you judge them more, or do you empathize more with them?
I think that the judgments I make against them are probably more severe, but that the empathy is also more lenient. And I know that's a kind of self-contradictory answer.
No. I think that makes sense. You get it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. I get, you know, the act. I get the ennui. I get the
temptations.
Yeah, I get those. Because I cave to them many times myself. Yeah. But I mean, at the same time, I'm also very sensitive. I'm sensitive to not using what I referred to in the past as the overly diplomatic gush language that teachers are often tempted to use when talking with kids about their problems. I like the word problems. I don't like the word challenges. Challenges is too easy to gloss over. The word struggles is also one of those words that I think teachers are often tempted to use when trying to just not get to the heart of the matter with parents. And so, you know, for a parent-teacher conference, you know, parent and teacher sit down and the teacher says something like, well, you know, Brooklyn's had a lot of struggles this year, but I'm hoping to see her through, and it's a growing age. And what Brooklyn's mom really needs to hear is your daughter shoots her mouth off in class and she says a lot of shallow things. That's not some kind of generic struggle. Everybody has struggles. Telling a parent that their child has struggles is meaningless.
It's like saying your child tends to eat lunch.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. This distinguishes them from absolutely no other human being. Like your child has struggles this year. The best students I have struggles. Right. Right. So the talented students who care and are obedient to their parents and try to be pious, they have struggles. And the impious, disobedient slackers have struggles too. Like, there's no point in saying that a child has struggles. So, you know, I don't want to hear that my kids have struggles. I need to know what those struggles are. Yeah. I need to know that my children are...
The problem.
Right. What's the problem? When you say struggle with what? Are they arrogant? Do they shoot their mouths off? I was those things. That means that they're certainly tempted to it.
So when you talk about problems, is the opposite, try to kind of phrase this. You said the students have struggles, but when you talk about problems, are you referring more to the idea of the problems that they cause, that they make? So how are you defining problems specifically, and in what way is it different than challenges or struggles, specifically?
I think that teachers are going to be tempted to try to couch problems in such a way that does not lead to an uncomfortable confrontation.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Okay.
So if you some of this is semantics, some of this is word choice, but I think it behooves teachers to choose sometimes, not all the time, but it behooves teachers to choose a slightly more confrontational language when talking with parents. Mm. Once they realize that they are tempted to use this gushy language, that it's easy to blow off. So if you tell a parent your child has struggles, but you know, I have hope that they'll overcome them, there's absolutely nothing that's going to keep most parents from just nodding their head and moving on. Whereas if you say your child has some problems, period, full stop, then any good parent's going to say, like, what? Like, what do you mean? And there you get into a potentially difficult conversation because it often happens that parents want to deflect problems that their children have. As growing pains, dark night of the soul, nothing to really work on.
Being a kid,
boys will be boys, and they just don't take it. They don't take it seriously. I don't know what parent teacher conferences sounded like when I was in school. I guess it's possible that some of my teachers told my parents, you know, your kid's kind of a jackass, which is what they had every right in the world to say. And then my parents didn't take that seriously. I tend to think my parents were often told, like, you know, Josh is a pretty good writer. He should develop that talent. Yeah. As opposed to Josh is an insubstantial thinker and relies on style over content and never really says anything interesting. He just says it in a kind of cursive-y sort of way. I don't know how much good that would have done me, But it was only right and fair that some teacher would have said that to me. But as it was, I often got, and I wrote an article about this last year. I often got these comments like, Josh could be doing much better than he is. Which when a 16-year-old boy hears, he could be doing better if he tried harder. What he hears is actually, you don't need to try harder. Just keep at this, same level of commitment as you are, and everything will probably turn out okay.
So how did it begin to sort of shift for you? Did something come to your attention and you made a choice to be different as a student and as a person, or was it sort of a gradual process because of the right influences and all those sorts of things?
There was a moment, there was a definitive moment where things began to change. There was a point where things began to change for me personally. And in How to Be Unlucky, I talked about a few of the more important moments in my life, one of which, of course, was the birth of my first child. And I'm not convinced that I really knew how to pray before the birth of my first child. I had spoken to God, and on a few occasions believed that he had heard me, but real fervent supplication did not take place until my first child was born. Speaking with God in a way that I was confident he was hearing, and I was really confident that I actually meant what I said. Maybe that's it, that it was on very rare occasions in my life that I actually felt like I meant what I said when I prayed before I had my first child.
Yeah, like deep down in your soul method.
Yes, that I don't have, there were times when I was praying for my child when I just did not have anything deeper to say than what I was saying. And I felt, there were times when I felt like Orwell in Until We Have Faces, where she asks, why should the gods listen to us until we know what we want to say? And I felt in a few of those moments, the very first few months that Camilla was alive, that I actually knew what I wanted to say to God, that the things that I was asking for were in fact the deepest yearnings of my heart, and that it just didn't get a whole lot deeper than that. And so that was that began to change things. I began to think of myself more in terms of someone who could speak to God after my first child. But the moment, I think that was kind of an intensification of a moment that occurred right after I got married. And as I said in my book, I was never really much of a reader when I was younger. And I was the kind of student that brags about passing a test on a book that I didn't actually read.
Zach's definition of a student who's a smart, bad student.
Yeah, that's right. Like,
when you hear that's the very example.
That's
the
absolutely definition. Right. right after I got married, I was not a book reader, and my wife Paula was. And right after I got married, something important happened, which was right after I got married. My wife had a good job at Washington State University, and I was on her healthcare plan. And I finally got a pair of glasses that worked. And maybe there are readers who also know this, but if like me, you grew up with a lousy pair of glasses and didn't know it, and then finally got a pair of glasses that really worked, it's like it's a revelation.
Did you have headaches and things like that? Like reading would give you a headache?
No, it wasn't that it gave me a headache. It was that it just kind of vexed me, where like I read for 15 minutes and then wanted to throw the book across the room. And I'm not saying that there's a purely scientific explanation for that. But after I got married, I got this decent pair of glasses, and then I started reading books, and it didn't bother me. And I was strangely capable of reading for long periods of time without being vexed by it. So I suppose that, you know, the material explanation there is that I just needed a pair of glasses. But I mean, I had also been bound in marriage to a reader. And I'm not willing to discount the kind of, you know, mystical explanation for why I suddenly wanted to read books was that I became one flesh with a reader. And maybe this is also an explanation of why I suddenly didn't mind reading books and kind of liked it after, you know, 25 years of not liking it.
Yeah. And when you learn to love the things that people you love.
Right.
Too. Or you, maybe learn is the wrong word, but you, I guess there is something probably mystical about that, right?
Yeah. That you borrow the loves of the people that you love.
Yeah. They pass it to you.
Yeah.
My wife is a photographer. She studied photography in school. And before I knew her, and actually my good friend Graham is also, that's a sort of a minor version of what we're talking about here, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I would never have, I mean, I thought, oh, that Ansel Adams photo is cool, right? The mountain is cool. But you learn to her a love of that art form.
Right.
And her passion for the things she was learning sort of becomes passed on to me. And I, while I'm not gifted as a photographer,
right,
I've learned to appreciate and love things that I never would have cared about before her.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I'll never be close to the photographer that she is. Is Paula a, here's a chance for you to throw your wife under the bus. Is Paula is she a really skilled reader? Like, does she exhibit as a reader the things that tend to make good readers good at what they're doing?
Here's what I would say about her. I would say that she has a bookish personality. So
in learning to love her, you learn to love books because she has that sort of like spirit about her.
Right. I don't know how many, I forget whether I've written anything about this, for the Circe website or not, but my wife and I met when I was only 15 and she was 16 and we went to high school together.
Yeah, it's referenced in the book.
Is it referenced in the book? Okay.
Yeah, in passing.
Okay. So, I was this, you know, this awful person in high school, and she was this bookish person in high school. Like, she played the cello. I remember going to her parents' house for her graduation party, and both of her mother's an English teacher and her father's a doctor of acoustic physics at Wazoo. And their home is just encrusted in books. Books are like this, you've seen that episode of Star Trek, The Trouble with Tribbles, where like the little things just, that's what books are like in their house. And their house has this kind of great, comfortable, slouchy feel to it. Like you
imagine. Like a great library.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. Or you know, the furniture just recedes you in such a way that you want to sit there reading a book for a long time. Mm. And, you know, her father was almost always reading a book whenever I was over when we were dating later on. If we go back to Josh Gibbs at the age of 16, when I kind of fell in love with her, I wore Doc Martens and dyed my hair black and listened to Korn.
What is this? The early 2000s, like 99, 2000?
This is like 97, 98.
Okay. Oh yeah. You were 16. Okay.
So yeah. I just had terrible taste, you know? I remember Paula and I were on the same mock trial team in high school. And I remember thinking, she is a very bookish person. And she made me want to like lead a quiet life. And she made me want to, even in high school, I don't know, prefer milder things than I did. And that effect was only, you know, redoubled after we got married, you know, 9 years after I met her, 10 years after I met her. So, I mean, I don't think that she has, you know, really in-depth reading skills. You know, she doesn't read with a pen in hand. She tends to read very quickly, but she reads a lot. And she's read a lot. She's read far more than I have. But she, the fact that she reads just seems very consistent with the kind of, you know, mild and pleasant person she is. And that person was very, that personality was very attractive to me. So I think that's what was about her that made me want to read, at least on a superficial level.
So if you have a bad student, then you need to find them a person,
right,
who exhibits all the things that you want them to change into. My dad, I tell this all the time on this podcast, various interviews and so forth.
Yeah.
That my dad used to always, you know, when people, we'd have all these books in our house. Our house was books everywhere. My dad, you know, there were way more books than a person could ever read in their life, right?
Right.
And I suspect that many of them have been sold or, you know, eventually given off to the kids or whatever.
Sure.
But he used to say he wanted the things you collect and that you surround yourself with tell a lot about the kind of person you want to be.
Right.
And then, so that, you know, I've always thought about large people who collect books that have libraries that collect, you know, what you collect. So there's an aspirational thing, an aspirational essence to the things that you collect.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, you know, that there's that aspiration in Paula and in the house that she was in, and that aspirational sense, that aspirational essence was appealing to you as someone who kind of just floated around. Would you say that you lacked aspiration? And I don't mean aspiration like you lacked the desire to be super successful and have a lot of money, but that there was just generally a lack of aspiration in you?
Not just throughout high school, but I mean, immediately after high school too. I mean, I dropped out of college 3 times. It took me 10 years to graduate with a bachelor's degree. I graduated high school in 99, graduated with a bachelor's degree in English in 2009. I was in and out of school for a very long time. And I mean, that was because I went to a really exceedingly mediocre university. But it was also because I suffered very badly from spiritual malaise and acedia, and I just didn't really care. I couldn't really be troubled. I really wasn't that worried about the condition of my soul really until I married. And as soon as I married and as soon as I had kids,
the panic set in.
That's right. Like I had, all of a sudden, there was this possibility that, I might not spend eternity with the people that I loved. Because I always knew back when I was living, you know, kind of risible bohemian life. If I go to hell, these people are obviously going to hell too, because we live the same
kind. We're going to be there together.
At least we'll be there together. But then I married this woman who was far better than me, and I had kids, and the thought was, these people I love are good people and I am not. And so, if I go to hell, these people are not definitely going with me. So I think that was a big part of wanting to get my act together, was this kind of fear that I would be separated from people that I love. I'm still worried about that. Like, fear of going to hell is still a regular thing that I pray about and I work through with my confessor and
fear and trembling.
Yeah, right, right. Fear and trembling. And you know, sleepless nights. So,
do you think if you had gotten married younger,
yeah,
that getting married and having kids would have had the same effect on you?
That's an interesting question.
Like, as in other words, you know, you didn't care so much about the malaise of your soul when you were younger, right? I think was the way you put it.
And yeah.
So you were in your what?
Mid-20s
when you got married. So no, if you'd been 21 or 22, as opposed to, I don't know, 25 or 26.
Right.
And then how old were you when your oldest daughter was born?
She was born in 2009. So I would have been 28, I think.
Okay. So if she'd been born, I don't know, when you were 6 years earlier, do you think that would have, I mean, obviously it impacts you differently, but do you think that particular part of it, that it made you just want to be a better person would have, and I don't, I'm not, that's not a leading question.
Yeah. Yeah. I do. I think, I mean, I was like most human beings, I was not ready to get married when I did. And I don't know that I've ever met somebody who was ready to get married. I think might be one of the great things about marriage, is that you can prepare for it. It's one of the things that you can prepare for, but not be ready for.
Yeah, I guess in some ways you can be less of a jerk, generally speaking.
Right. You're right. Less or more, but
right.
You're not going to be fully prepared for it. And that's maybe... You're not going to be fully prepared for it. So, I mean, the thought of getting married, I thought I was ready to get married when I was 21. I had a very serious girlfriend when I was 21, or what I thought was a very serious girlfriend. And it ended up not panning out, but I was ready. I was ready to marry her. You know, that was, she was really my first serious girlfriend, and it was, you know, it was good to have a serious girlfriend even back when I was 21.
Cause it made you think about something besides yourself.
Right. It made me, it allowed me the capacity to think about really something kind of beyond this world. And I don't think, I mean, I've kind of said this, I think people might've taken it glibly, but I've written before on, you know, what I always say when students ask me, you know, what do you think of, Mr. Gibbs, what do you think of high school love? And I always say, I think high school love is great as long as it's very painful and unrequited. I'm totally fine with it. I think every sophomore and junior boy should be hopelessly devoted to some girl in school and never say a word about it. Just kind of painfully, idolatrously pine away for this person, like Dante for Beatrice, and just never speak it. I think that could be. I think that romance is good. I think that a crush is very good for pretty much anyone, or that it's potentially very good. Some of the most, you know, the most ennobling things about high school for me, given that I didn't care enough about my studies, were kind of these little infatuations that I had with people. And I mean, those kind of things are. On the one hand, they're petty and they're kind of obnoxious and they're pointless to talk about. If a 16-year-old, you know, sophomore boy has a huge crush on some girl, that's probably the only thing that's going to get him to iron his clothes and sit up straight if he's not naturally inclined to do it.
Right.
It might be enough to make him read his Bible. It might be enough to give him, you know, better taste in music. He might buy a tube of chapstick because there's a girl out there and I'm tired of having chapped lips and looking like I'm in eighth grade. So I think that, you know,
could
I think
do the opposite though, couldn't it?
Like
if the girl is not I don't know, worthy or something that could do the opposite though.
Or
are you saying that the act of devotion itself is the devotion itself.
So I'm kind of following the sweet new style poets, of Dante's era who were trying to, redeem courtly love. And, you know, this is Bernard of Clairvaux and a lot of the cult of Mary that emerges in the, 12th, 13th, 14th century, is this attempt to get men to think of women in a non-sexual, platonic, and idealized way. And the woman becomes this icon of God's mercy. And the woman is interpreted as this kind of perfect person. As is, true of Dante and Beatrice, I think everybody has to decide for themselves when they're reading the comedy about whether Dante goes too far. Most people today, I think, would claim that Dante goes too far in his devotion to Beatrice. I'm not one of those people. I think that the fact that Beatrice ultimately delivers Dante into the hands of Bernard, who delivers him into the hands of Mary, who delivers him into the beatific vision, and that God is ultimately at the end of this, justifies his devotion to Beatrice. So I've also never had much time for I think every guy has probably heard of the classmate who gets dumped because the girl says, I realized that I cared more about you than about Jesus, so I had to dump you. I've never bought that line of argument. I find it, even for all the lenience that must be given a 16-year-old girl, I think it's profoundly petty to say something like that. Because most human beings love their children more than they love God. And like, what are you going to do when you're 29 and you have a child and you realize that you love your little child more than you love God? What are you supposed to do then? Most people just care about other human beings more than they care about God. And that's a thing to be overcome, not a thing to be indulged. But I think that it's more of a cross to bear than it is a thing to run away from. So, obviously you get some guys who are kind of creepy, but I don't want to write some, blank check for that. But I mean, it's for this reason that I think that the greatest devotion, at least in high school, is this kind of unspoken, purely internalized thing that no one ever really finds out about. And I think that there's great examples from literature of these kinds of things where you've got, it's often a man, maybe because, men have contributed more books to the Western canon than women have, but there's some man who, carries a torch for some woman for a long time and never says anything about it. And it comes as something of a surprise when it's finally revealed. And you can tell often in the moment of the revelation that this quiet, suffering devotion has ennobled the man. And it's not tearing him apart in a way that will not heal him stronger than he was in the first place. So I could point to a few moments in my life where a petty crush was an ennobling thing. So to get all the way back to your original question, I'm glad I didn't marry younger, but all things being equal, would I be better off today at the age of 37 if I had married younger? Yeah, I think I would have been. I think I would be.
I guess you'd have more years of practice.
Exactly.
So to speak.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about, shift gears slightly because for time's sake.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you talk about in the book about that sort of changed your life, for lack of a better word, helped you go from bad student to a good teacher. I'll say good teacher. when you discovered the consolation.
Yeah.
So we're true. Talking the constellation of philosophy,
right?
Boethius book or Boethius book, depending on how you want to pronounce it. How do you pronounce it?
I would say Boethius.
Okay. So we'll say Boethius for this show. I've heard about three different versions of each, three different people say each of those things. So now I'm even more confused than normal.
Right.
But we'll go with Boethius since that's what you say. And so you discovered, you say in the book that you discovered the constellation relatively early in your teaching career, right?
That's correct.
And it sort of changed the way you thought about both books and about teaching. Is that a fair way of putting it? And
yeah, I would say so. Absolutely.
So, well, why? and you know, the book's about that. Don't tell the whole story of the book, but.
Right. The book is very humble. And I think that's the most important aspect of the book that I found compelling was that this is a man.
You mean the constellation of philosophy?
Yeah, the constellation
of philosophy. Your book is humble.
No, Boethius is humble. I'm trying to be like Boethius. Readers can decide for themselves whether it's a successful homage to Boethius. But Boethius is very willing to slay his own ego as he draws close to death. He does not do much of he doesn't do a very good job defending himself. And he presents himself as kind of a petty person throughout the book. And of course, we have to ask whether a petty person could actually present himself as a petty person. I don't know. That would be our judgment to make, not his. But he presents himself, the character of Boethius in the Constellation, is this petty person who makes a paltry attempt to defend his honor and nobility for about the first third of the book, but really kind of gives up on that pretty early. He ceases to defend himself really beyond, I think probably beyond book two in the Constellation. He doesn't really defend himself, and he begins to slowly acknowledge that he has a lot of repenting and turning to do in his last few days before he dies. I found that incredibly moving. I found it, very moving at the age of, 28, 29 to read this story, because the Constellation is something of a story. It's a dialogue between fictional characters. To read this story about a man who on his deathbed, had the wherewithal to write the Constellation, but also, the humility to present his life as largely having been wasted. I think that Boethius more or less admits that his life was wasted because on his deathbed, he admits that he did care too much about earthly glory. And he had justified his pursuit of earthly glory through many different kind of spacious means. But in the end, he admits it. Yeah, all this I did for human glory. And I've got a lot of turning to do, at least intellectual turning, before I die, that my soul might be properly postured toward God so that death is not terrible for me. As somebody who was, I read the book at a time when it only makes sense that people would start looking back when you have your first child, right? I don't know how any sane person cannot make a very full reevaluation of who they are and what they've done when they have a child. Having a child is a second chance, I think. It's a chance. Everything changes. It's almost, the moment that you have a child is almost really like if all of human history is like a human life, and if a human life is like human history, the moment that your child is born is like the moment of the incarnation. It's Christmas whenever your child is born. And all the rules change, with the incarnation. And this new thing begins in human history where there's this great reconciliation that starts. And we get the sense throughout the book of Acts that the old ways are dying. And, you know, the oracle at Delphi dries up, and the pagan gods have their teeth broken, and there's this new way of doing things, and the cathedrals are built, and religion comes to mean something very different, given that we serve an omnipresent God as opposed to a circumscribed God. And I think that all those changes that take place in human history are kind of mirrored when your child is born. It's like the nativity, you know? And so, you know, I was having this, this kind of moment while I was reading the Consolation or teaching the Consolation for the first time. And it was like all of these things aligned so that I could receive the book with gratitude. And I was glad for the opportunity to look back over my life and, you know, chagrin most of it and to, you know, be done with a lot of it.
So, so you like Boethius in the book, you're looking back at what you've done with your life to this point, but unlike Boethius, you're right. kind of being given a second chance. Whereas Boethius is basically, right. again, he's been condemned.
Right. Boethius will not get a chance to go back to Rome and see his two sons with new eyes and appreciate his wife the way that he ought to. But he does have what he needs. He has a few days left to spend in prayer. And that's kind of the impression that I get when the book concludes. He might only be, I don't know, hours away from death. And I don't know historically what the length of time was between the finishing the Consolation and his execution. Yeah. But I have to imagine that a lot of it was just spent in prayer. I mean, there's nothing else to do, nothing else to do in a jail cell. So, but he does have what he needs. He can make it, you know, he can make it right with God. If, you know, I mean, if the thief crucified beside Christ had enough time to make it right, I think Boethius had enough time to, you know, begin making it right at very least. But he was doing it on his own. Whereas I've, you know, been given at least 9 years now in which to try to, you know, live a more honorable life, a more noble life, a life that I'm not so embarrassed by.
So did you love, I mean, did you love that book right away, or was it more something you were
so
struck by and sort of intrigued?
Yeah.
It was thought provoking to you.
It made, I have to say, not every book that I taught those first few years made sense to me on a first read. I didn't understand Burke's Reflections when I read it. I didn't understand.
You didn't understand Burke the first time you read it?
No, I hated Burke the first time I read it. Now he's my favorite political philosopher. But I have to say, the Consolation did make sense to me the moment that I started reading it. And I think that...
That's interesting.
There was no... I mean, I, you know, read the book 10 times by now, and it makes a different sort... The book makes a different sort of sense to me now, but...
like a deeper intellectual sense now, perhaps?
Yeah.
That maybe it wasn't intellectual at the beginning?
Right. I understand. So if you, you know, if listeners have not read the Consolation is divided up into five books. And the first three books of the Consolation will make sense to you the moment you read them. The last two books are more metaphysical, and they will not make sense to you the first time you read them. So the first time I picked up the Consolation and I was reading it, it, like I remark in How to Be Unlucky, you will encounter things. If, even if you're only 18, if you're 18 and you've spent most of your life watching, you know, Cribs on MTV, the first book of the Consolation will still contain a number of philosophical claims that are familiar to you. That's how omnipresent the wisdom of this book has become in the 1500 years since it was written. It's just everywhere. Basic things that you say to somebody when they fall and scrape their knee come from Boethius. It could be worse. There's plenty of fish in the sea. Things can only get better from here. I mean, these are all Boethian ideas. They're not, they sound biblical. Count your blessings is one of my favorite Boethian ideas. Not a biblical idea. I mean, you're, there are things about gratitude in scripture, but counting your blessings, not a biblical idea. That's Boethian. And everybody's been told, you know, count your blessings. You don't have to be a Christian to know count your blessings. You don't have to be a Christian to know that counting your blessings will make you feel better. You don't have to be a Christian to know that contemplating the fact that things could be worse makes you feel better. And the first three books of the Consolation are just kind of chock full with explanations of why these things, these claims make us feel better. So, you know, you don't need to know anything about philosophy. You don't have to be a good, smart person to jump into the Consolation and immediately understand the gist of the book. Now, I mean, that changes when you get closer to the end, but the book is, well, let me think about this for just a second. I'm going to go ahead and say the Consolation of Philosophy, at least the first 3/5 of the book, is, aside from maybe the book of Ecclesiastes, it's as accessible as philosophy gets. I can't, maybe The Little Prince is more accessible philosophy. I don't know. There's stuff in The Little Prince that I still think is kind of obtuse, where pretty much everything in the first three books of the Consolation, I think, makes sense on the surface. So
how do your students respond to it?
My students tend to like the Consolation quite a bit. I certainly spent a long time teaching it. It's a book that I teach early in the year, and proportionally I spend a longer time on it. But I think by the time I'm done teaching the Consolation, and maybe this would be true, you know, people who read How to Be Unlucky, my students tend to think of Boethius in terms of the stories I've told to make Boethius clear. And I don't know that my students are distinguishing, you know, between the Hastings story that I tell and Boethius's claim, he who has much wants much. I think that those things kind of go together for them. And so, you know, if they like the Consolation, they also kind of like everything that goes along with the Consolation. Yeah. They might not like it if they just sat down and read it on its own. But I mean, yeah, I would say my students tend to like it.
Yeah. When did you sort of, well, one of the big parts of the book of How to Be Unlucky is the idea of sort of educating towards virtue.
Right.
When did that sort of come into focus for you? We probably need to wrap this up soon, but when did that come into focus for you, and how did this book sort of play into that? I mean, when you started teaching at 28 or 29 or
right,
you said it was, were right. you at that point, were you saying, I'm in this because, you know, the goal of what I'm doing here is to make virtuous people?
So no, that was not the language. That was a kind of buried intent that I had, but that wasn't the language that I used. Right. The language of virtue became something that I actively pursued. I think after I went to the Alcuin retreat in Grand Rapids, Michigan, 6 years ago, that was where. I think that's where I met Andrew Curran for the first time. I was at that conference when I heard somebody quote, I'm probably going to mangle the quote a little bit, but Walker Percy's, what does it matter if you get all A's if you flunk at life? That was, I think I overheard, your father say, something like a classical school has to be willing to die. And those claims kind of got me moving more toward the language of virtue in the way that I taught. And I also began at that point really rethinking my philosophy of testing and quizzing. And that's kind of when virtue as a discrete grammar kind of entered into my classroom.
So how did that change your classroom?
Like, what did that mean? How did it manifest itself?
Yeah. I was a bit, when I first started teaching, I was kind of jaded on the subject of grades, and I was a terrible, offender so far as grade inflation was concerned when I first began teaching. What I really wanted, and it didn't take me more than a year to figure this out, that if you give students good grades, everybody will leave you alone. which is something that I kind of accepted this with a cynical attitude. And when virtue formation became a thing that I spoke about in the classroom, inflation kind of began to go away. And
because the grades mattered less, good or bad, like the specific number they were getting.
Yeah, and I also wanted to start using grades, not to get people off my back, but I wanted to start using grades in a psychologically realistic sort of way.
You mean like in a way that was truly assessing the things that needed to be assessed?
I try to evaluate my students in terms of grades in a way that reflects the way that people grade and evaluate things in the world outside of school. The most common grade that I give is an 84. So I really try to mainly keep my grades to 74, 84, and 94. And I explain to my students, an 84 means good, not great. You covered the subject. You didn't say anything that was surprising, but you didn't really let me down. This is a grade that's like you go to a restaurant for the first time and the food is okay, and you don't think that you really need to ever come back, but you weren't really disappointed. It was just fine. Mm-hmm. That's what an 84 means. An 84 means like, I don't really feel the need to explain this grade other than you did fine. You didn't really mess anything up. It's okay. But an 84 is also like, this is not really ambitious work. There were no risks taken here. This is just kind of middle of the road. An 84 means I see a lot of first impressions here.
Why an 84, but not like an 85? Like,
an 84 is, I think of an 84, and this might be, grade inflation generation talking here, but I think of an 84 as the most average score you can possibly give. I mean, other people would probably take exception to that, but
you can do whatever you want. I'm just curious.
When I was kind of putting this idea together and kind of writing my rules of decorum, it could have been an 82, 72, and 92.
Yeah,
but the 84 struck me as this kind of maudlin grade, a grade that was not going to excite anyone, mm-hmm. but was not going to deeply disappoint anyone either.
Yeah, I guess if you get to 85, you get to that 5 point, and psychologically, it feels a tad bit more than that 84.
We could round this up to a 90.
Yeah, we accomplished something.
Right. Whereas I think of an 84 as like room temperature water. It's completely inoffensive.
Is that more psychologically impactful to a student than just saying like a B minus?
I think that once a student knows what a B minus means, it is. But you have to, I think that you have to establish, the teacher has to establish the meaning of an 74, 84, 94, if you're going to use those grades. So by the end of this school year, this last school year, I had graded over, it must have been somewhere around 1,300 quizzes and tests. And I gave 11 perfect scores all year, 11 100%. And that's not on, I mean, that's on like actual written work. I give, you know, reading quizzes from time to time, and you might get like a 3 out of 3 on those. But in terms of a 100%, I only wrote that score 11 times. And I would typically announce it when I was giving it out. And every student that I have knows what a 100 means because I wrote this little description of what it means to get 100. To get a 100 means your work could be easily confused with adult work. This sounds like something someone 10 years older than a high school student would write. There's not only ambition manifested in this work, but some achievement of high goals. This is worth reading twice. I might need to read this twice to understand it, not because it's poorly written, but because it's well written. And I'm only gave that out, you know, a handful of times, and it meant something because I dished out a lot of 84s and 74s over the course of the year. So, I mean, I think that I want to try to establish, realistic grades, psychologically realistic grades. So that, you know, the average student who does average work doesn't have an overinflated sense of what their work is worth, but also so that there's a kind of verbal accompaniment to the grade. So, I mean, I would rather students think of the descriptions of the grades than the grades themselves. I guess it might be worth my time to just write out the descriptions of what each of the grades means at the top of the paper, as opposed to a number. But yeah, that's what I'm working with right now.
Well, you know, kids got to do something with that. Got to like do some interpretation of it.
I guess this is true.
Well, I should probably sit down and just record a whole conversation on not a debate, but just a whole conversation on grades and how that works.
That would be fun.
Well, for the sake of time, we should probably wrap this up for today, but congratulations on How to Be Unlucky. I really like this book. I mean, I'm not just saying that because we published it. And I kind of worked on it a little bit with you.
Right.
Actually, I didn't really work on it. I just read it and gave you some notes. Let's be honest. You know, I really like this book and I think it's a great book. I hope a lot of people buy it, obviously, but I think it's an accomplishment, put it that way.
Thank you.
So thank you for writing that. And I think it's going to be meaningful to a lot of people.
I hope so.
And thank you, of course, for being on the show this week. People want to find out more about you in particular. Should they, what do you want to follow you on Twitter?
Yeah. No. go through old articles on the Cedar Room, my column on Cersei's website. Although I guess if you want to see the dank memes that I make, you could look at my Twitter.
Well, you know, there is a place for that apparently on the internet. So people should be into that sort of thing.
I hope so.
Otherwise, what are you doing?
That's what Twitter is for. Dang me.
Exactly. It's for like testing your stuff, testing your material.
That's right.
Well, again, thank you for joining me. Thank you for writing this book. And we will talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you, David.